Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When Michael Brown was shot and killed by police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri last August, we saw many stories about racially segregated neighborhoods with high poverty and unemployment rates. In a new report for the Economic Policy Institute, research associate Richard Rothstein writes, quote, "Private prejudice and suburbanites' desire for homogeneous, affluent environments contributed to segregation in St. Louis and other metropolitan areas. But these explanations are too partial and too conveniently excuse public policy from responsibility. A more powerful case of metropolitan segregation in St. Louis and nationwide has been the explicit intent of federal, state, and local governments to create racially segregated metropolises." Richard Rothstein has a new report out called The Making of Ferguson, and it talks about the conditions that created Ferguson. He says that they cannot be addressed without remedying a century of public policies that segregated our metropolitan landscape. Remedies are unlikely if we fail to recognize these policies and how their effects have endured. Richard Rothstein is research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and senior fellow at UC Berkeley School of Law. His latest report, The Making of Ferguson, argues that federal, state, and local government policies created the inequality and poverty in racially segregated neighborhoods. And we are currently trying to get Richard Rothstein on the line. And so I'll tell you a little bit about his report, and you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org. to read it. And actually, I'll just open up the phone lines while we try to get Richard, because his main point is that the media are focusing on high poverty, unemployment rates, oppressive policing, and more in racially segregated neighborhoods. But he says that white flight is just too simplistic. He argues that government actions that ended in the late 20th century continue to determine today's racial segregation patterns. So what really strikes you about the media's coverage of what we see in places like Ferguson? High poverty, high unemployment rates, oppressive policing. What are your thoughts about how these stories are framed? And then what do you think about Richard Rothstein's argument? Hopefully we'll get him in a minute, where he talks about the fact that we really need to look at actual government policies, and that's how we got here today. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And then a lot has happened over the last 2 weeks. We took a break. We played a lot of rebroadcasts, but so much has happened over the last 2 weeks when it comes to Black Lives Matter and these issues getting a lot of attention. So what's really struck you over the last 2 weeks? 866-798-8255. Richard Rothstein has a new report, The Making of Ferguson, and in it he writes, "In St. Louis, these governmental policies included zoning rules that classified white neighborhoods as residential and black neighborhoods as commercial or industrial, segregated public housing projects that replaced integrated low-income areas, federal subsidies for suburban development conditioned on African-American exclusion, federal and local requirements for property deeds and neighborhood agreements." He writes about a number of people who moved to the suburbs in St. Louis, a number of blacks specifically, who couldn't get loans from the government. And so they actually had to have their friends, white friends, buy homes and then place the name in the black name because they couldn't get the property. So these are just a few of the things that Richard Rothstein writes about in his latest report, The Making of Ferguson. Richard is a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and senior fellow at UC Berkeley School of Law. And I believe we have Richard on the line. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. So you wrote a very extensive report, The Making of Ferguson, and you initially write about media coverage of racially segregated neighborhoods with high poverty and unemployment rates. What really strikes you about that coverage?
Well, when the Ferguson troubles developed last summer, most of the media reports were struck by the fact that this was taking place in a suburb, not in the inner city, which is where these kinds of incidents have happened in the past. And they explained how suburbs like Ferguson became almost all black and almost all low income or lower moderate income by saying that there was white flight when African Americans moved into the suburbs, and that's how it became all black. They said also that real estate agents steered families to Ferguson and not to other suburbs. And that's really not how it happened. Of course, there was white flight, and of course, real estate agents were discriminatory in how they operated. But the major cause of the segregation of St. Louis metropolitan area, of Ferguson, and other communities in that metropolitan area, as well as communities like Ferguson around the country, was explicit and purposeful federal, state, and local policy that created a segregated metropolitan landscape, not only in St. Louis, but around the country. And so what I did was try to explain much of the history, which has now been largely forgotten, but used to be quite well known, about how federal, state, and local policy purposely segregated the country by race, residences in not only St. Louis, but in metropolitan areas in the north, in the Midwest, in the east, in the west, as well as in the south.
And you argue that remedies are unlikely if we fail to recognize these policies and how their effects have endured.
Well, that's correct. I think that in order to undo this, we need to refamiliarize ourselves with the history, because if we think that this happened only because of private prejudice and whites fleeing blacks, it's hard to think of what you can do to undo that. But if you recognize that these racially segregated patterns were created by public policy, then you can begin to think of public policies that can undo them. For example, one of the most important policies that segregated the St. Louis metropolitan area was the creation of suburbs by the federal government on a whites-only basis. The country suburbanized in the 1940s and 1950s, primarily because the federal government, through the Federal Housing Administration, guaranteed loans to mass production builders in order to create suburbs, and the condition of the bank loans that these builders got, required by the FHA, was that no homes be sold to African Americans. And the FHA even provided these builders with clauses that they put in the deeds of the subdivisions that they were creating that prohibited anybody who bought into the suburb from reselling to an African American. And in the Bay Area, they're all over the place, are these suburbs that were created with this kind of FHA requirement. Probably the best-known one is Westlake and Daly City, the subject of the Malvina Reynolds song about ticky-tacky houses. But throughout the Bay Area, suburbs were created by the federal government. They couldn't have happened if it were not for the federal bank guarantees, and they had an explicit racial requirement. Well, to take an example that I just gave, in Daly City in the 1950s, those homes sold for roughly two to three times national median income. Returning war veterans were able to buy those homes. Lower middle class and working class families were able to buy those homes. They were affordable. In today's dollars, those were homes that were selling probably for about $150,000 in today's dollars. Well, whites were permitted to buy those homes. Blacks were not. And as a result, the white families who bought into those homes in the 1940s and 50s had 50 or 60 years of equity appreciation. Those homes now sell for $300,000, $400,000. The difference in between $150,000 in today's money that they were purchased for back in the 1940s and 50s and the $400,000 for which they sell today is equity appreciation, and that has created a middle class from the working class and lower middle class families, white families that bought into it. Blacks did not benefit from that equity appreciation, and it can't be remedied simply by saying, oh, well, now we're no longer going to discriminate and blacks can buy into it, because those homes are unaffordable to middle-income families today.
And we're still feeling the effects of these policies, because you tell really interesting stories about specific people and how they were affected. So let's talk about Adele Allen. A black engineer moved to Kirkwood, a nearly all-white St. Louis suburb, in 1962 after his white friend made a, quote, straw purchase, where the true buyer was hidden because, as you said, the Federal Housing Administration would not issue mortgages to blacks in Kirkwood and no bank would issue them. And then in 1970, Adele Allen testified before the Civil Rights Commission about life in Kirkwood when he first moved there. He said, quote, "I don't know if the police were protecting me or protecting someone from me. We had patrols on the hour. Our streets were swept neatly, monthly. Our trash pickups were regular and handled with dignity. The street lighting was always up to par." And then things had changed by 1970 when his mostly all-white neighborhood had become a black outpost in an overwhelmingly white St. Louis County. He testified then, "We now have the most inadequate lighting in the city. We have people from the other sections of town that leave their cars parked on our streets. What they're making now is a ghetto in the process." So you take these policies and then you explain how they affected neighborhoods over the decades.
Well, that's right. That's one of the policies, the public policies that created the segregation that we know today. Slums were created by the federal government primarily because African Americans were concentrated in tight urban areas and not permitted to buy homes elsewhere. So those neighborhoods where they were permitted to live became overcrowded to a much greater extent than white neighborhoods simply because they were not permitted to live elsewhere. As they became overcrowded, people doubled up. The area became more deteriorated. Landlords stopped keeping up the property. And, as you just pointed out, cities began to provide fewer social services, municipal services, not social services, I'm sorry, municipal services like garbage collection and street lighting and road maintenance and so forth in black communities. So they became slums. The white families in suburban areas looked at these neighborhoods and concluded that African Americans were slum dwellers. And so when African Americans moved into suburbs, whites fled thinking that blacks and slums were the same thing, not realizing that the slums were not a characteristic of the people, but a characteristic of the public policies that created them. So there was some white flight. That's certainly true. And the white flight was based on this stereotype, but the stereotype had been created by explicit public policy.
Can you talk a little bit more about other laws that we need to know about? Because in your report, you say a lot of this history has just been forgotten or ignored, and it's really important to go back and look at these policies. What else really struck you?
Sure. Well, another big one, in addition to the explicit creation of white suburbs by the Federal Housing Administration, probably the other biggest one was the public housing program. Public housing was administered by the federal government and by cities and other jurisdictions that created public housing as a segregated program. In St. Louis, for example, when public housing was first developed, it was developed in what were integrated urban areas. Working-class families were living in integrated patterns in the downtown St. Louis, as they were in many urban areas in this country, because there wasn't a lot of public transportation available, and there are factories downtown, and workers were walking to work. And so immigrant families, white immigrant families from Europe and African-American families, were all living in the same neighborhoods. What St. Louis did was it raised those neighborhoods. It's R-A-Z-E-D, not the They destroyed those neighborhoods in order to create public housing, and they created housing projects for blacks and housing projects for whites. Public housing at the time, I'm talking now in the 1940s and early 1950s, public housing was the most desirable housing available because we had a national civilian housing shortage. So most public housing was for whites, but they were separate projects. St. Louis cleared one integrated area on the north side of the city and built a blacks-only public housing project there, and then cleared another area of the city slightly to the south and built a whites-only project there. So the public housing program served to not just to reinforce segregation, but even to create segregation that previously hadn't existed. In 1949, President Truman proposed a national housing program to vastly expand the public housing efforts of the federal government, and many of the most famous public housing projects that you're probably familiar with were created under that 1949 act. the conservatives in Congress, when the act came before Congress in 1949, who were opposed to any public intervention in private markets, proposed an amendment, what's called a poison pill amendment, that is an amendment designed to make the whole program unpalatable. So Republicans in Congress, conservatives, who are opposed to public housing because of its government involvement, proposed an amendment saying that public housing had to be integrated. And knowing that if the amendment had passed, that Southern Democrats who supported public housing would then abandon it and there would be no public housing at all. So their objective in proposing that public housing be integrated was to destroy the public housing program. Liberals in Congress, led by people like Hubert Humphrey and Paul Douglas, argued against the integration amendment, and saying that if the integration amendment were passed, there would be no public housing. So the integration amendment was defeated, and public housing proceeded under the 1949 Act on a segregated basis. Any public housing project that was authorized by the federal government and administered by states was placed in black neighborhoods if it was for blacks and in white neighborhoods if it was for whites. As the previous program that I described, the Federal Housing Administration's creation of the suburbs and the white suburbs proceeded, the civilian housing shortage for whites began to disappear, and whites left public housing because they were able to move to the suburbs at affordable prices, leaving public housing solely the province of black families. In St. Louis, the most famous public housing towers, called the Pruitt-Igoe Towers, giant towers that gradually deteriorated because whites had all moved out and they were concentrating more and more low-income families, black families in the projects. They were originally created, one of the towers was for whites, the other tower was for blacks. As whites were able to move to the suburbs, they no longer could fill the whites-only towers, and they filled them with blacks. They became such a disreputable image of public housing that in 1972, the federal government and the city of St. Louis evicted all the tenants of that public housing project and demolished them. They dynamited them. There were very famous pictures, and in the report that you mentioned that I wrote, I have a picture of the dynamiting of the Pruitt-Igoe Towers there in St. Louis. Well, the families who were living in those towers had to go somewhere, and they gradually pushed into adjoining neighborhoods in St. Louis and eventually to nearby suburbs like Ferguson, which is how Ferguson came to be all black. It was not just the demolition of public housing. It was also the urban renewal programs throughout downtown St. Louis. You may be familiar with the arch, the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, the monument to the westward expansion of the United States. Well, that arch and all the surrounding property was all once a vibrant African-American neighborhood. It was all destroyed in order to create this monument, and other urban renewal projects in downtown St. Louis were created for expansions of universities and downtown commercial activity. So black families were gradually pushed out of their traditional ghetto neighborhoods, and since they were not permitted or able to buy into many suburban neighborhoods, they concentrated in inner ring suburbs, like Ferguson. And the same thing is happening around the country, and it's happening in the Bay Area as well.
Richard Rothstein is Research Associate at the Economic Policy Institute and Senior Fellow at UC Berkeley School of Law. You can read his latest report, The Making of Ferguson, on our website. You can also see the photo that he just talked about, the demolition of that public housing project in St. Louis in 1972. It's also on our website. His report looks at federal, state, and local government policies. He says they created the inequality and the poverty and the racially segregated neighborhoods. He says says that so many of the media reports we're seeing today are just too simplistic, talking about white flight, whites leaving neighborhoods once blacks enter. But he says it's a lot deeper than that. We need to really look at history to understand how we got here. So if you have any questions for Richard Rothstein about this history, how Ferguson became Ferguson, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Like I said, Richard, you've got some stories here of Adele Allen, a black engineer who moved to an all-white St. Louis suburb in 1962 after his white friend made a straw purchase where the true buyer was hidden. You have a lot of stories like this. For example, pastors tell their churches, I wasn't allowed, quote, allowed to buy a home, and then all of a sudden he's allowed. Can you give us some more examples? There were also lawsuits by World War II veterans who wanted to live in white suburbs.
Yes, there were a number of those suits. Perhaps the best-known one was one that challenged restrictive covenants. I referred to those earlier, and those exist around the country everywhere in the Bay Area as well as in other northern and midwestern cities. These are language attached to deeds. From state to state, the particular form of the deed varies, but it was language attached to deeds that prohibited the sale of a home or resale of a home to an African American. As I mentioned, the language was dictated by the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration. Well, in 1948, the Supreme Court ruled that those restrictive covenants could not be enforced in state court, but it didn't say they were unlawful in themselves. They couldn't be enforced to the extent that if a family were to sell a home to an African American, state courts were no longer, after the 1948 Supreme Court ruling, permitted to evict or cause the eviction of the black family who had bought it. But since the restrictive covenants themselves were not unlawful, neighbors could still sue the seller of the home for damages for selling to an African American, and that went on for another 7 or 8 years until the Supreme Court prohibited that as well. By the time this kind of policy was ended, the suburbs were well on their way to being established as all-white neighborhoods. Now, the case that I mentioned, the 1948 Supreme Court, happened to come out of St. Louis, a St. Louis neighborhood where the restrictive covenant had been organized by a neighborhood association that was based in a local Presbyterian church, and the Presbyterian church provided the funds for taking the case to the Supreme Court to defend its restrictive covenant in the Supreme Court. And this church, and this was not unusual, it was true again around the country, this church received tax exemptions, as any church does, from the IRS, even though it was the leader in efforts to promote racial segregation in the St. Louis area. And that was an unconstitutional act on the part of the Internal Revenue Service, and churches and other institutions across the country that were tax exempt were leaders in this effort to restrict communities. Probably one of the best examples comes out of Chicago, where the University of Chicago had its own general counsel.
And hold that thought. Well, I'll ask you to talk about what happened in Chicago right after we take a break. Richard Rothstein is research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. You can read his latest report, The Making of Ferguson, at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about the future of fracking in California. Some are predicting that New York's ban on the practice will pressure California to do the same, but Governor Jerry Brown is pushing to expand the extraction industry. In the November election, two California counties passed preemptive bans on fracking. So what's next for fracking in California? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today to talk about the conditions that created Ferguson and other suburbs like it across the country, we'd love to hear from you. Today's guest, Richard Rothstein, argues that those conditions cannot be addressed without dealing with a century of public policies that segregated our metropolitan landscape. He writes, remedies are unlikely if we fail to recognize these policies and how their effects have endured. You can check out his latest report, The Making of Ferguson, at yourcallradio.org. Richard Rothstein is research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and senior fellow at UC Berkeley School of Law. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on the media's reporting on poverty and unemployment in racially segregated neighborhoods? Richard says what's really missing is context and history. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And how do you think we can get this information into the dialogue that we're hearing about what is happening in Ferguson and suburbs across the country? Before we go to calls, Richard, do you want to tell us the story about Chicago and what you brought up before the break?
Well, I was just telling you briefly about how the federal government granted tax exemptions to major institutions that promoted segregation. In Chicago, the South Side of Chicago, which is a segregated area, except for the enclave that the University of Chicago was located in, it was the University of Chicago itself that organized these restrictive covenants that I mentioned, and its own legal department initiated lawsuits against any homeowner who dared to sell to African Americans, all the while enjoying tax exemptions as a public charitable institution that was pursuing public policies that were consistent with public policy. So this was another example of how government action created the segregation that we know today.
We have a Facebook comment from Billy who says, what about other groups like Asians and Latinos? We know that these policies applied, for example, to Chinese people.
They did. California in particular had a Chinese exclusion, but throughout the country, on a nationwide basis, the most severe discrimination, public discrimination, existed against African Americans. It is true that there was some in California against Chinese, but to nowhere near the extent that it did against African Americans, and it disappeared much earlier than it did against African Americans. One of the curious things in California was that restrictive covenants frequently mentioned a prohibition on sales to either African Americans or Mexican Americans. Yet Mexican Americans were, the courts refused to enforce them against Mexican Americans, saying that they were white, and the courts only enforced them against African Americans in California. So I'm not certainly minimizing the extent to which other immigrant groups did suffer from discrimination, but African Americans in this country are have a unique experience, descended from American slaves and subject to a century and a half of explicit discrimination by law after the Civil War.
Well, thank you for the comment, Billy. Let's go next to KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Dr. Rothstein for taking me to school today, and I feel pretty ignorant having had no understanding what our government that African Americans and everybody else paid taxes to was doing against them. And my desire is that his information be taught at the sophomore level of every high school in the country. It's that important, I think, to our understanding of the wrongs committed, and I just want to thank him so much.
Well, thank you for calling. Richard, again, you say that we really can't move forward until we talk about this history. Are you seeing these conversations taking place? You say you're not seeing this in most media articles, but how do you think we should bring these issues into the conversation? How can we do that?
Well, all I can do, I'm sorry to say, is I can do my part. I've written this report. I've written many other articles about this, and I hope that other people will do the same. This used to be well known, and we need to re-educate the American people. You know, in 1968, Richard Nixon was elected president, and he appointed as his Secretary of Housing and Urban Development a fellow named George Romney, who was the father of the recent presidential candidate. And George Romney announced that because the federal government was responsible for segregating metropolitan areas, this was not a controversial statement at the time. Everybody knew the history that I've described to you on this program earlier, and Romney referred to it. He said that because the federal government was responsible for creating what he called a white noose around inner-city African-American communities, Negro communities, he was going to begin a policy of denying federal funds to any suburb that didn't accept its fair share of low and moderate income housing, that didn't permit public housing for African Americans to be built in the suburb, and that didn't repeal its exclusionary zoning ordinance. That is an ordinance that prohibited the construction of apartments in suburbs that were overwhelmingly single-family homes. And he did this in order to remedy the federal policies that had created segregation. Well, he began this program, and after a couple of years, he was reined in by the Nixon administration and eventually forced out of his position as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And the Open Communities program that he had promoted came to an end.
How did the public respond to that program?
Well, it was this was probably part of the reason why the Nixon administration reined him in. There was a resistance on the part of white suburbanites to having apartments built in their communities for African Americans, for low and moderate income families. So the Nixon administration, looking now by about 1970 towards the Nixon reelection, was planning an election campaign based on the white backlash to integration efforts, and it canceled the Romney program. There were some people in the Nixon administration who supported it. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was Nixon's domestic affairs advisor, and he very vigorously supported Romney's efforts, but he had to leave the administration as well. So there was certainly this is a controversial area. As the recent events have indicated to everybody, our racial history is not a thing of the past, our racial polarization, and certainly there was resistance among white communities. But instead of pursuing the policy and insisting on it, the Nixon administration backed down, and that's the last we've heard of any similar policy in the country. So we need to re-educate people about the history that was well known 40 years ago, and hopefully if we do this time, there'll be a more willingness to support policies to undo it. The kinds of policies that Romney proposed are still necessary today.
Wow. Richard Rothstein is Research Associate at the Economic Policy Institute. You can read his latest report, The Making of Ferguson, arguing that federal, state, and local government policies created racially segregated neighborhoods and the inequality and the poverty that we see today. And thanks for the call, KDF. Rob has a question. He says, this is a fascinating show, really tying together so many things. Do you know how integrated the Fillmore District was in San Francisco before it was redeveloped? Do you know, Richard?
I don't actually know a whole lot about that. I do know that in San Francisco, much of the city, almost all the city except for the Fillmore District, was restricted to African Americans back in the 1950s and 1960s. There were restrictive covenants throughout the city. The major builders, Henry Dolger, for example, who later went on to build Daly City, but built the Sunset District in San Francisco, built it all with FHA advance guarantees on a restricted basis. So the history of San Francisco is really not any different from what I described in St. Louis earlier.
Well, thank you for the email, Rob. It would be an interesting show, actually, to look at that. Since we're talking about covenants, I wanted to ask you, in your report, The Making of Ferguson, in the covenants section, you write that covenants were promoted nationwide by the National Association of Real Estate Boards, which provided model language. In St. Louis, the Real Estate Exchange provided a, quote, uniform restriction agreement, end quote, for neighborhood associations to use. By 1945, about 300 neighborhood covenants were in place, and these instruments took two forms. In one, home builders attached clauses to property deeds committing the first and subsequent buyers of a house never to sell that property to an African American or permit the property to be occupied by one. Whatever happened to these restrictions that were implemented by the National Association of Real Estate Boards?
In San Francisco and the Bay Area, as well as in St. Louis and every other city in the country, these are still on attached to deeds. A few, I've actually gone to the recorder of deeds in Alameda County and gotten a looked up deeds and found these restrictive covenants still on them. They're not enforceable anymore. As I indicated before, the Supreme Court in 1948 said they couldn't be enforced in state court to evict African Americans. And then in the mid-1950s, I think it was 1957 perhaps or 56, the court added that they couldn't even be used to sue homeowners for damages for selling to African Americans. But even though they're not enforceable, they're still on deeds, and many of your listeners, I'm sure, have them on deeds. They don't know about them, but they're still recorded in the, at least in Alameda County and in San Francisco County and in other Bay Area counties, and they're still there on the records, and you can see them if you go search them out.
I read a quote earlier from Adele Allen, the man who moved to a white suburb in St. Louis, and said when he moved there, all of the services were on time and they were functioning really well, like trash, for example, lighting. And then once the neighborhood became predominantly black, everything switched. Can you talk about how that happened? Because you've got a section in your paper, Denial of Adequate Municipal Services in Ghettos, and you write that city services like trash collection, street lighting, and emergency response were less adequate than in white neighborhoods. African Americans paid higher rents than whites for similar space, about 25% more, according to one post-war estimate, because their demand for apartments was greater and because less adequate city fire protection led to higher insurance rates for landlords. So can you talk about that process? How did that switch so quickly?
Well, I don't know specifically how it switched in Kirkwood. Adele Allen testified to it. But in cities, it happened because as neighborhoods become more and more overcrowded, as African-American neighborhoods did because they were not permitted to live outside very restricted ghettos, in order to maintain those neighborhoods, you need to increase the level of civil city services. And so as they become more overcrowded, if the city services did not proportionally increase, then they would be less adequate. If you have more people living in a neighborhood, you need more garbage collection. If you schedule garbage collection in an overcrowded neighborhood at the same rate that you schedule it in a neighborhood of single-family homes, you're going to have garbage piling up and slum conditions being created. So that's one way it happened, is simply by not doing anything, you have less, fewer community services, civic services. So far as street lighting and that kind of thing, you just don't get to the priority list when the Department of Public Works or whatever it's called in your particular city schedules street lighting or repairs. But this was, in 1968, President Johnson appointed a commission, a well-known commission called the Kerner Commission, to investigate the causes of riots the previous year around the country in black communities. And one of the conclusions of the Kerner Commission was that this was systematic around the country, that the black neighborhoods had less adequate city services than white neighborhoods, and this was one of the things that was contributing to the ghettoization of metropolitan areas around the country. So, again, as I say, the Kerner Commission was a widely read report. Everybody was familiar with it. This was, at that time, very well known. And we've simply forgotten about it in the last 40 years and not paid attention as the ghettoization of the African-American population has just shifted around from downtown areas and now increasingly to inner-ring suburbs.
Richard Rothstein is research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. His latest report, The Making of Ferguson, argues that federal, state, and local government policies created the inequality and poverty we see in racially segregated neighborhoods. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about this history, we're also going to talk about solutions. Richard says in order to move beyond this, we need to first recognize this history. He's got a whole section on solutions in his report, and we'll talk about that. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you grew up around this time, you've seen these changes, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from GS in San Leandro. Hi, GS. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Richard, thank you. Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I'm slightly paraphrasing, but that's the capstone of the First Amendment. It goes all the way back to the Magna Carta in 1215, when if the king did not redress the grievances of the people within 40 days, they had the right to wage war against the government. I don't think we need to go that far, but I do believe there's no question that, especially in the court case of Marbury versus Madison in 1803, very famous case, no provision of the Constitution was meant to be without effect. That's my comment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have another caller on a law, so let's hear from Nancy, and then we'll get a response. Nancy in the Bayview. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I want your visitor to talk about the Jesse Unruh Act that was passed when I was in college in the late 60s. It was supposed to stop all these covenants about not being able to sell your house.
All right. Thank you. Richard, are you familiar with that?
Well, yeah. As you probably know, there was a California in the early 1960s passed an anti-discrimination law, but it was subjected to a referendum, and the voters repealed it, largely by lobbying and a campaign for repeal led by the California real estate industry. The Supreme Court then invalidated the referendum, saying that it was an unconstitutional act to repeal the anti-discrimination ordinance. So the anti-discrimination ordinance came back into effect. But this all happened in the 1960s, and by then the suburbanization that I talked about before that had been created by public policy was well established, and the equity appreciation was well on its way that I also referred to. So simply saying that you no longer are permitted to discriminate in the sale or rental of housing doesn't undo the policies that created this segregation. It needs the kind of affirmative policy that I mentioned before that George Romney proposed, for example, requiring every suburb, every jurisdiction to have its fair share of low and moderate income housing, that is prohibiting suburbs from having ordinances that don't permit the development of apartments in their suburbs and maintain them as exclusive single-family home communities. We need policies that require every neighborhood to have its fair share, not to turn it into an African-American neighborhood, but to have so that the population, the disadvantaged population, is distributed throughout the metropolitan area so the children can go to schools that are integrated, which we don't have now. So that would be another kind of policy that we would need to pursue. We probably should reinvigorate the public housing program, not in terms of building high rises, but scattered site throughout the metropolitan area so that the low and moderate income families can live in middle class communities, and we won't have this kind of segregation that we have today. So all of these kinds of affirmative policies are necessary. In 1968, the Fair Housing Act did have a provision that required every municipality to affirmatively further fair housing, but that requirement has never been enforced. The only laws we have on the books that are enforced are prohibiting discrimination in the sale and rental of housing. And as I said, that in itself will not do much to undo this history.
Richard, what are your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement? Because I've talked to a lot of people involved in it who say that there are so many elements to what they're fighting for, and it's getting really nasty. I mean, I don't know if you read about this, but over the weekend, a number of activists, protesters, citizens, they're called Black Brunch, and they go into like restaurants, for example, where people are having brunch, and they read off names of Blacks who've been killed, for example. And I went on Twitter this morning, and it's just nasty what you're reading out there. A lot of really angry racism. So what are your thoughts on this movement? And a lot of people are trying to bring up these issues, but they're having a hard time because, the backlash is so strong.
Well, I think that it's important to raise these issues, and you can't, it seems to me, fear raising the issues because of the backlash. But the thing that I want to emphasize is that it would be short-sighted to think of the problems that we've been facing in the last few months as being problems simply of policing, of discriminatory policing. Of course we have discriminatory policing. We have excessive, if that's too mild a word, incarceration of young African-American men. But this happens because of the neighborhoods are segregated, because the places like Ferguson, where it started, or is a segregated Black community. And unless we deal with the underlying issue, which is the residential segregation that exists throughout all metropolitan areas in the country, we're going to continue, it seems to me, to have the kind of police behavior that was so outrageous in some of the instances like Ferguson and Staten Island and elsewhere that we've seen. So we certainly need to protest the police tactics, and I think the Black Lives Matter protests are very, very much appropriate. But we need to look beyond simply police tactics and understand that these are reflections of a segregated society.
Well, you also report that when you look at inequality and poverty, these policies play a huge role. You write, the lower incomes of African Americans today cannot be understood in isolation from the history of pervasive housing segregation. By keeping Black families out of better off suburbs, segregation not only deprives them of the opportunity to build wealth, but also the better suburban jobs they had difficulty accessing.
Yes, that's true. And I illustrated that with St. Louis. African-Americans couldn't get to some of the best blue-collar jobs for which they were fully qualified. McDonnell Douglas, for example, was headquartered in St. Louis, and it was very difficult for African-Americans to get there because they could only find housing for the most part in downtown St. Louis, and there was not adequate public transportation. So there were many contributing factors that created lower Black incomes, in addition to the inability of Black families to accumulate wealth such as white families were able to do because of their access to the private housing market. Today, nationwide, African-American incomes on average are about 60%, so 60% of average white family incomes, but average Black family wealth is only 5%. Of average white family wealth. And this is all attributable to the housing segregation that was implemented by the federal, state, and local governments throughout the 20th century. Lack of access to jobs that I just described was another one. Discriminatory labor markets, even if Blacks did have access to jobs, was another one. Again, using a St. Louis example, because it contributed to the segregation of Ferguson, St. Louis was the site during World War II of a large ammunition manufacturing facility, employed 40,000 workers. This was clearly a government operation. It was making the ammunition for World War II, for rifles and other implements of war during World War II. They would not hire African Americans. This was a government contracted ammunition facility. And they finally agreed to hire African Americans as the war ended. But at that point, the jobs were disappearing.
Hmm.
So again, white workers were able to benefit from the big boost of income that took place during World War II because of the defense industry, which and certainly this was a big issue in the Bay Area. White workers in the shipyards in Richmond and elsewhere in the Bay Area were able to save a lot of money in World War II. They had good jobs. Blacks were mostly excluded from those shipyards in Richmond and elsewhere in the Bay Area.
Just quickly, Richard, we have about 30 seconds. Are you seeing governments tackle this? You write that New Jersey has taken a modest step, for example, towards requiring every community to permit development of housing to accommodate a fair share of its region's low-income and minority populations.
Well, it's taken a very modest step, but it's even its very modest step is unique in the country. There's no place else that's done that. And the steps that the federal government has taken to try to remedy this are very, very modest and inadequate to deal with the segregation that we find throughout the country.
Richard Rothstein is Research Associate at the Economic Policy Institute and Senior Fellow at UC Berkeley's School of Law. You can read his latest report, The Making of Ferguson, at yourcallradio.org. He argues that government policies created the inequality and the poverty we see in racially segregated neighborhoods. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What's the future of fracking in California? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the fight surrounding fracking. Some predict that New York's statewide ban on the practice will pressure California to do the same, but Governor Jerry Brown is pushing to expand the extraction industry. In the November election, two California counties passed bans on fracking. So what's next? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.